Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We're thrilled to bring you this big, big show tonight. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and thrilled is not the word. We are just ecstatic. We're having the time of our lives right now because since we got up this morning, it's been a nonstop media frenzy.
It really has been, yes. We have a huge show tonight. We have four guests, lots to talk about, but while we're waiting for our first guest to call in, I guess we need to mention this. We are planning, as our listeners know, we're planning a tribute to the films of Roman Polanski next Sunday. And, of course, our tribute shows, we love doing them, and we're most known for our tribute shows. This one is really interesting because we've spoken in the past week to some very fascinating people, collaborators and close friends of Mr. Polanski. Yesterday we spoke to Brett Ratner, who is a close friend of Roman Polanski's.
Very close. And it changes a lot of what he said yesterday, I think. You know, a lot of things now come into new light with what happened this morning. So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think what he said still holds
true, but I mean, it's just there is some stuff in that interview with a particular recent project that definitely is like, oh my God.
Well, yeah, and that project just got a lot more interesting because today the big news is that Mr. Polanski, after 31 years, was arrested in Switzerland with the intention of extradition back to the U.S. For the 31-year-old charge.
Right.
So, you know, and it was in Switzerland where this took place. Who said that the Swiss don't take sides?
That's neutral my ass.
Anyway, we actually spoke. We're focusing on the films of Mr. Polanski for this tribute. But pertaining to films, there was a film earlier this year that we actually covered on this show with the director called Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired.
That is right.
A terrific documentary, and the results of which have led to an interest in reopening this case. And we got an interesting scoop from Brett Ratner concerning this film and plans for a possible sequel in the future.
Right.
And we wanted to play this clip for you. Should we go ahead and play a little clip now, a teaser of next week's interview waiting for Mr. Rooker?
We should do that just because we want to leave people wanting more, so...
Yes. Okay. So play it now. Is that what
you're
saying?
Yeah. Play it now. And as soon as
I can't
Henry
catch the signal.
Henry comes on,
yet.
We cut it.
Right. Here it is. It's only 2 minutes long. Here's Brett Ratner speaking about that project.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've seen the documentary Wanted and Desired.
She's on the show.
Yeah, she's on the show. We've seen it. It's a great documentary.
Yeah. So Marina, you know, Roman had nothing to do with that movie. He didn't even see the movie. I actually saw the movie. We had a screening. Marina screened the movie at my house, and I invited Roman's friends like Bob Evans and Warren Beatty. I think Bob Town was there, I don't remember, but a bunch of his friends came to see the movie before Roman even saw it, and because he didn't really want to sway anyone's opinion. He wanted it to be an honest depiction of what happened, and I think Marina did a brilliant job. Are you there?
Yeah.
So now Marina's asked me to produce the sequel to Wanted and Desired because so much has happened because of that film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now probably the case is going to go to the Supreme Court and so much is going to happen now. And so I am so lucky, and I think Marina is such a brilliant filmmaker. She won an Emmy. for best director and I think best writer, but she did a brilliant job, and I'm lucky to be working with her. So I'm producing the sequel to Wanted and Desired.
Oh, that's amazing!
Oh, that's great news. That's wonderful.
You know, and now Roman will be a part of it. I mean, I think now because now it's really more about the outcome of what's happened since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Roman has agreed to participate. What time is it?
Okay, just one last question. But he's at a really good place in his life right now. Even so, it seems to me that he would probably choose to stay at the place where he's made his home in France, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I don't really get into those details. I mean, he has a great life. He's a great family. I think to clear his for peace of mind. I think, you know, this case has just been going on too long, and it's just ridiculous, and the injustice of the judicial system is so obvious in Marina's film. So I don't think it's about a desire to come back to the United States. I think it's more about peace of mind for him.
Yeah,
and I think that's something that I think he deserves. And I think the family's forgiven him, the girl, the victim given him.
Yeah.
The rest of the world should forgive them. It's give him. It's not his business. And the L.A. judicial system is corrupt. You know, so
I absolutely agreed.
It's horrible, and so this is. I think for him, I think I would love to see that happen for just his peace of mind. It would be great.
Obviously, that was an unedited clip.
Very unedited, yes.
Yeah, but you got the gist of it, and that's just a little section, a little taste of a half-hour conversation we had with Mr. Ratner.
Yeah.
About the works of Polanski. So that's one of many interviews we'll be covering on next week's tribute show. The next week's tribute show also, so far, includes William Fraker, who is the DP of Rosemary's Baby, and we learned was also slated to be the DP of Chinatown.
That's true, yeah.
There's another 35-year-old scoop we got.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have Bobby Osteen, the wife of the great editor Sam Osteen,
mm-hmm.
who edited three of Polanski's pictures and was just insanely crazy about them. And then Keith Ulick, a critical roundtable with Keith Ulick on Polanski's career. That's what's on the agenda so far, and we're probably going to be adding to it as this week draws on.
Right.
It's going to be a great show, and Bobby's on this show tonight.
On tonight, so, I mean, we got a lot to look forward to. But we have Keith, though, and, you know, it's always a pleasure to have Keith on the show.
Yeah. Mr. Rooker has not called in yet. My last correspondence with him was last night, and we talked, and he had all the details, so we're just waiting for him to call in. So what's new, Jerry?
I'll tell you what's new. Is, you know, I get up this morning with this news, and, you know, I'm just thinking to myself, wow, you know, all the stars, you know, line up, all the planets line up correctly, and it's not even December 21st of 2012 yet, and they're lining up already. But, you know, what's new, well, what do you want me to say? I mean, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, you wind me up, you know, you give me a couple bottles of wine, and I'm like, you know, I'm the best thing that happened since Don Rickles and Dennis Leary. So
I'm thinking, have you seen anything this week?
Well, I saw the Jane Campion movie, Bright Star, the thing about John Keats, you know, and the lovely woman who was his muse, the Bright Star of the title. It's okay.
Is it a little too Masterpiece Theater?
You know, Jamie, were you in the theater with me and my mom watching that? Because she said the same thing, you know. She goes, this is very Masterpiece Theater. And it is. It really is. That's what's interesting. The problem is the first half of the film is lacking any sort of intensity.
Mm-hmm.
Anything. Now, I have John Keats, I was a poetry major in college, creative writing poetry major. And I remember one of my professors telling us a story of Keats. And, you know, it's a very tragic story. Now, you know, Michelle, in the chat room, I think Abbie Cornish was incredible in the film. I think the first half of the film is missing something. Now, visually, I think the film is incredible. Visually, this film, like any Jane Campion film, is astounding. I don't think it's a bad film. I actually think it's quite good, but it takes a while to get into. But for me, it's really Abbie Cornish's movie more so than anyone else's.
Right.
Even Ben Whishaw and, oh, God, what is this guy's name? The actor, the other actor, is it Paul Schneider from All the Real Girls? Is that the name I'm looking for?
I think so.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I mean, the performances are good. I like Ben Whishaw. It's the second time he's played an important poet. The first time, Bob Dylan in I'm Not There, and now John Keats. So, God, he's played Bob Dylan and Keats in one lifetime. That is incredible. But I think it's Abbie Cornish's movie because I really do think that was Campion's intent to really focus more on her than anyone else. I like the movie. I don't think it's a masterpiece, but I like it better than Campion's last film In the Cut. And it's a beautiful looking movie, and if you're willing to take it up, it is worthwhile in the long run. It's not going to hit you immediately, but it's an interesting film.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm interested in seeing it, and it's the return of Jane Campion.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. I'm sending Mr. Rooker an email now.
You've got to, too, because you've got to remember, like, Henry and the Portrait of the Serial Killers was made originally in 1986, and I didn't see it till, like, 1990, but, he doesn't know, he might not know about, these things, dude, he's the man. He's the scariest person I know in my cinematic nightmares.
I love it when I call upon you to fill time.
No, because look, and as I said, I'm like Don Rickles, Dennis Leary, and that guy in The Hangover, Zach Galifianakis. I'm all three of them combined.
Yes.
And the Bear Jew. But,
we can.
Let's see. What else can we what else do you want to talk about? No dead air. We can't have dead air in this. So, did you watch Saturday Night Live last night?
I'm trying to type this email. This is the beauty of live radio.
No, did you watch Saturday Night Live last night?
No, I did not. I normally don't, and I usually regret it when I don't, because...
Well, you should not. You have nothing to regret today, because it really... I didn't think it was funny last night.
When has it been funny? It hit a stride around the presidential election.
Yeah, and this is my thing, though. My thing is this. They have this thing they do on Thursday nights, I guess, until... Maybe, what is it, 30 Rock starts, and then they're going to stop? I'm not really sure. But they do these this special thing on the politics and everything on Thursday night, and they had Amy Poehler on last Thursday night, and it was very funny. I was watching at the gym.
Oh, the prime time. Yeah,
okay. The prime time. And very, I'd really like to – Lorne Michaels, I love you. You're a genius. Get rid of the Thursday night thing. Include that stuff on the actual show because
right.
It needs it.
Right.
I was really thunderstruck by – and I love these guys. I love some of these people they have on the show. I mean, they have Kristen Wiig, who's so funny. They
yes, she is.
Sandberg, Bill Hader, and it just wasn't. It wasn't clicking last night. I mean, I was.
I believe our first guest is on the line.
Let's go for it.
Let's go.
He must have heard the show and was like, I can't stand that guy's voice.
Yes, our first guest tonight is one of our favorite character actors. His performances are marked by a jolting volcanic intensity in his resume. It's filled with some of the most revered films of the past two decades, films like JFK, The Bone Collector, Cliffhanger, The Replacement Killers, Tombstone, Mallrats, Eight Men Out, Rosewood, Mississippi Burning, and who can forget Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which will be released on Blu-ray this Tuesday. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Michael Rooker. Mr. Rooker, are you with us?
I am. I certainly am. How are you doing, guys?
We're doing great.
My name is Jamie, just for introduction, and Jerry, my co-host, is here with us, too.
Hey, Jerry. Jamie.
Hey, it's great to have you on our show.
We're so excited to have you on. We're great admirers of your work. Give me a sense of how that determination to break into acting started, because I know that you studied in Chicago, Goodman School of Drama, and I'm wondering, why did you take to it? What about acting excited you?
You know what? I think it started way before I went to theater school, and back when I was just a wee teen, And I never really pursued it, but I always had that desire, and... eventually, after I'd gotten out of college and everything, I made the choice to pursue that as a career, acting as a career. I didn't know much about it, so I ended up going and auditioning for this theater school out of Chicago called the Goodman School of Drama. Ended up getting accepted and spending a 3-year conservatory type school, you know, there with those folks, and I got out and started doing theater. I don't know where the drive came from. It was just there. Maybe you're just born with it. Who knows? Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably right. But even so, when you watched films or you saw certain performances, were there particular inspirations for you among actors?
You know, when I was a kid, I grew up watching, you know, comedy, mostly comedy and horror movies and action, but mostly comedies. Abbott and Costello, action stuff, or drama, the horror movies, you know, basic stuff, Dracula, and just all the really bad movies, you know. Real B movies. I was a big B movie fan,
but aren't all movies, in a sense, in one way or another, at least when we were growing up, B movies? Very rarely, you know, there's an A movie every now and then, but essentially all movies are like B movies. We have that genre. Yeah, I mean, but we have B movies, but with A-list casts now. That's all.
Yeah, we love movies, you can tell.
Yeah.
But that's interesting that you were a horror fan, because obviously you broke out pretty early with Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is known as one of the scariest films ever.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that opportunity came about for you.
Well, you know what? I was doing theater at the time, so I was in a play. The director of the piece was hired to do the prosthetic work for the movie Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And he had turned me on to the situation where they're looking for this guy for this movie, and they couldn't find him anywhere. And he said I ought to go over there and, you know, throw my hat in. So I did. We were dark on Mondays, so I went over there on a Monday after work and auditioned. Ended up getting the role. It was just really that simple. I had no idea about the auditions, and it just sort of came about in that kind of way, you know.
And Henry was, I don't know how you prepare as an actor, but I know that it's loosely based upon Henry Lee Lucas. So how did you prepare? Did you review any information you could find on the real life counterpart, or what did you do?
They had a little bit of background on the guy, and they had a couple of copies of a TV show, 2020 or something like that, where someone was interviewing this guy who was a serial killer, and the director had copied it and brought it to his the guys he was working for, who a company called Meljax out of Chicago, and they're a video distribution company, and they asked them if they would like to make this movie, you know, a little independent, low-budget horror thing. And they said, yeah, they gave him, you know, they gave him this money. He didn't really have a script at all. I mean, he had ideas on a 3x5 cards, you know, and the copy of that interview that I'm not sure who the interviewer was, but it was a pretty famous person at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how it got started. That interview is basically all I had, and one other video that was taken in the prison of Henry Lee Lucas being interrogated by the Texas troopers, and that was kind of a long shot. It was a shot from a security camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was those visuals actually were quite helpful, because you can see from those visuals his body language, especially the security camera one. You could really see how he sat in the chair, and you know, it was not good, great lighting. It was just, you know, he was in his jumpsuit there being interviewed, and it was pretty interesting. So I started reading about this kind of stuff, and all the stuff that I read really wasn't really quite that helpful. But the visuals, the first interview that I saw, and also that security camera interview was. They were both quite helpful for me, anyway. Right.
Yeah. Now, I know that this film, because I remember it before it even got released, it already achieved kind of an infamy.
Mm-hmm.
People were whispering about it, and I understand that it really took hold. It had a premiere at the Chicago Film Fest in '89, and it caused a big sensation. Were you there when it premiered, and what was that like?
I was. And me and the producer, the director, and we were all there watching and hoping we'd get people responding and reacting in some way, at least. Our really big break came when Harold Morris, I believe it was, chose Henry as his director's choice for Telluride. That was the first time the movie had ever been seen with any sort of real audience.
Yeah.
You know, other than before that, and maybe we had like 40 people in the theater, just friends and neighbors and anyone we could pay and bribe to come watch the movie. that was the big break during the Telluride Film Festival. And we were all there hanging out and waiting, and first time it was ever screened. It was only supposed to be screened once, but after the first screening, about halfway through the first screening, rather, about half the audience got up and left.
Wow.
And we're sitting in the back row smiling and clapping. We really, truly enjoyed that, you know, half the people got up and left. I don't know why.
You know, it's working.
It's fine for that kind of film, though, because it's a hard film. I mean,
right. It was working. It was moving people in some sort of visceral way to get up and get the hell out of there, you know?
Yeah. But it's one of the scariest films I've ever seen. I think the home invasion sequence is still one of the most frightening things I've ever seen put on film.
Thank you. And that was all captured by my own little hands with the video camera.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I did not know that. Okay. Wow. Okay.
All that footage of the home invasion and all that stuff, I have the camcorder, and we're using the camcorder.
Right.
I'm using it, taping it, and you know, when the kid comes through the door, the teenager comes through the door, I have the cinematographer right behind me. So I basically just flip the camera over backwards. He grabs it and turns it one more flip and lands it on a sandbag, and so that you can still see all the action take place. But it was, So I did double duty that day.
But I got to say, because of that sequence, I used to sleep with a machete by my bed for a long time. I'm not joking. I have a machete, and I used to sleep. Because that scene, Michael, you did something that no slasher film could ever do. And that's what I love about the film, is it's so realistic.
It's a realism, yeah.
Yeah, it just really gets under your skin. Now, having said that, I know that you reprised the character for a music video, and there have been talk for the last two decades of a sequel. Would you reprise that character?
You know what? A lot of people talk about that, and a lot of people would like to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not say, well, you know what, I definitely consider it, but
mm-hmm.
no one really wants to, I don't know of anyone that really wants to pay us any money to do it. I mean, if you know somebody, have them give me a call.
Okay, I will.
We'll put the feelers out.
Yeah,
I'll
get the word out tomorrow morning.
People can think up an
idea to do, yeah.
Absolutely. I understand that people approach you most about Henry, which is curious because you're one scary dude in that movie, so these people aren't too afraid to approach you. I find that amazing. But it's
and
such
with,
an...
With trepidation, they approach very gingerly, you know.
But even so, it's so... it's such an incredible performance, an incredibly real performance. I'm wondering if you found yourself struggling with typecasting after that film.
Immensely, yeah. I mean, at least once it got seen by an international audience, I mean, my God, I was coming out of the theater, and behind me, I'm listening to people talk about the movie. It did a little bit about the movie, and one of the comments that really stuck in my head was, well, that guy's never going to work again, you know, and it kind of pissed me off to hear that, but I understand where the cat was coming from. I mean, basically, because it was, you know, so strangely appealing, and people loved the movie. I mean, and it's a strange piece, and it's so real, and the realistic quality of it, the documentary kind of style shooting of it and all that stuff, really, that guy behind me who made the comment knew this poor actor is going to be typecast for the rest of his career, practically. And so, yeah, I was for a bit, I mean, I turned down so many things. I turned down probably about 14 movies overall in the next 3 years after Henry was actually seen by a wide audience were very, you know, similar in nature. Not Henry, but it was, you know, that kind of movie. And so I really fought against it. I think, I'm not sure what my next choice was, but I went back. I did some more theater, and I did a movie. Yeah, I got cast in a movie called 8 Men Out, John Sayles' baseball movie, and that sort of helped, you know. And after that, I did. Although after that, I went, you know, I got actually they drug me right back down into a gutter, you know. I did a movie called Mississippi Burning, and after that, I did Sea of Love.
Right. So
I want to ask you about these because these are movies that mean a lot to us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one movie in particular, and it couldn't be more different from Henry, that I think is one of the great American movies of the past 20 years, and that's JFK. And I wanted to know what you could tell me about the experience of making that film.
It was quite the experience, really. I mean, you know, you're working with Oliver Stone, probably Oliver Stone at his premiere peak, you know. He was such a hot director at the time. He would have been able to do anything he wanted to do, you know, and he chose this story. And I thought he did quite a good job with making this movie. I mean, and we were – he was – and a very intriguing director, you know. He gave general direction, and then he'd like leave, and he'd be in a little booth with the video camera playback somewhere no one knew where. So it was down the hall, the next floor, wherever he was, who knows. And he just let us go at it, you know. He liked that, and he loved seeing mistakes. He loved seeing people get in there and maybe forgetting their lines and having the ad lib, or getting in there and maybe the door doesn't open, or you got to pull it a little extra hard, or maybe you trip on something over the floorboard or something like that. I mean, he loved that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then again, he could be quite specific. If you weren't giving him what he wanted, he would just get down on your ass big time. My gosh.
I could see that. Yeah.
I can definitely see that.
Yeah. And he had no qualms at all about doing it either. So in front of anyone, I mean, if you're there and you're not putting out, he'd tell you right into your face, and you know, you could have 15 people around you. He didn't really care.
Yeah. Before I let you go, let me ask you about a couple of the people that you've worked with, and from this we can cover several of your other projects that we're crazy about. So what comes to mind when I say Tom Cruise?
competition. Mr. Cruise and I competed every day. I mean, we ran from our trailers to the set racing. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he set up, he had his trainer set up an obstacle course so that we had to run, we'd have to jump over a wall, we'd have to climb a rope, we'd have to go in with no feet, just hands. We'd have wheelchairs we'd have to race with, and all this was before we got to the set.
Mm. So that was a big testosterone kind of movie. You could tell by watching it.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, absolutely it was. Yeah, we had such a great time doing the movie, though. I mean, that was amazing.
Yeah,
great stuff.
And of course, the movie's Days of Thunder, for our listeners out there that might not know. Gene Hackman.
Mississippi Burning, yeah. Gene Hackman and I didn't have very many scenes, but the scene that is most prominent in my mind is the scene where he grabbed me.
right. Manhandled you.
I remember us talking about, well, how are we going to play this scene, you know? You just point the gun at me, grab him by the shoulder, grab him by collar, grab my hair. I didn't have much hair during that movie, so he didn't do that. What's he going to do? You know, what's he going to do? He's surrounded by all these redneck KKK guys, and he's going to go in there, and he's got a gun. Well, they have guns, too. So what? You know, so what's he going to do to really set the tone? And so the idea was, well, how about if we de-ball him? You know, de-ball the biggest balls there, you know? So. Pretty much it was me, and so I slipped on a football protection cup, and he went away, and all in the middle of the scene, he grabs me up and starts squeezing the cup, and during the middle of the scene, I hear the cup going,
oh, no.
Oh, man.
So I'm thinking, okay, now this is a little closer comfort. I think we better end the scene really soon. So so that's how that went down. It was interesting stuff.
Yeah,
he's an amazing actor.
Yes, he is.
You only had a couple of scenes with this gentleman, but this actor is actually my idol among actors, and that's Al Pacino.
Ah, yes. Sea of Love, yes.
Yeah.
Al and I became quite close friends during that movie. As a matter of fact, I spent 3 days straddling him on the bed. Became quite good friends. He was so loving and caring. He allowed my 215 pounds of muscle mass hanging out on him during and in between takes. The scene was an awesome scene whereby I break into his house and I'm going to kill him, basically. And and we end up on the bed and I'm like going to strangle him and beat him to death and all that stuff. And the whole sequence took about 3 days, 3.5 days. You learn a lot about someone when you have to do a fight scene with them.
Yeah.
And fight scene in close quarters, you know. So we actually had some amazing physical combat moves going on during that piece. So it was an interesting guy, very, very, very low-keyed, very, can be intense when he wants to be, but, you know, he's very, very great actor, yeah.
So far we've heard about you straddling Al Pacino and Gene Hackman grabbing you by the testicles. So let's go to Sylvester Stallone. What are your thoughts on that experience?
Well, if it wasn't for Sly Stallone, I wouldn't be in the end of the movie, you know, cliffhanger. It was him. It was Sylvester Stallone who convinced the producers to, no, we need Rooker at the end of the movie on the top of that 14,000 foot plateau with the helicopter coming up and looking at us. Instead of him and the girl alone up there, having this major heroic kind of image, he wanted me there as well, and because they were definitely trying to cut my ass out somehow. because they wanted it to be, you know, they wanted it to be the girl and the guy, you know, da 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 da, that kind of thing, you know, how Hollywood can be. So, no, man, we had a great time, and it's how I want to, you know what, after a while you start thinking, how does he get these roles where he only has, like, 3 or 4 words, you know? I mean, but, I want to do that, man. I want to get that kind of money and only have sound bites, you know?
No.
I mean, it's tough remembering scripts nowadays.
I would
exactly.
I would be remiss if I did not ask you what it was like to work on for the director, Kevin Smith, on the set of Mallrats.
Oh, my gosh. I loved Kevin. We're still great friends, good pals. Mallrats was an awesome, awesome piece. I still get asked about it all the time.
And I bet you stay away from chocolate pretzels.
Chocolate-covered pretzels? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It was, what a great sequence of events there. I mean, I remember the very first day I came onto set, the producer had convinced me to dye my hair sort of grayish. Because I, you know, basically I said, I think I'm too young to play this chick's dad, you know. I don't know. I don't think I should do this. And so he convinced me to gray my hair. And so I went there and they did my hair color and it came back orange and green or some crazy stupid color like that. And not only that, it burnt my scalp. So I was a little teed off. So I went into my room that night and I ended up shaving my head. Completely shaving my head. I didn't like the hair color. It just came off bad, and I was pissed off, so I shaved my head. The first time they saw me for the movie, coming onto the set, I had a completely new look, completely bald, with toilet paper stuck all over my head, because I was so pissed off when I shaved my head. I nicked myself 1,000 places. So but everyone was, like, freaking out. I mean, they were looking at me like, oh, my God. Oh no! Oh, this is bad. This is bad. And they walked up to Kevin and they said, "Kevin, what do you think? What do you think, man?" And he looked up from his Game Boy and said, "Ah, great. Let's shoot." So he's a great guy. Great guy, man.
When you look back through your career, what do you consider your time vault movies, the movies you're most proud of?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the ones we just spoke of, Henry, is a movie that just keeps coming back and again. People so respect that movie.
Mm-hmm.
If only, you know, it was a movie that was really well ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And 8 Men Out is one of my favorites. It was like being 12 years old again, you know, playing baseball all day long, fighting over who's going to get the next raps, you know, yelling on the ball in the ballpark. It's awesome, awesome, man. Of course, Mississippi Burning is really groundbreaking, and Alan Parker was such an awesome director. My goodness. I can just go on and on. Days of Thunder, of course. My goodness, you know, Days of Thunder was, you know, I in the Southeast, there are people who watch this movie all the time. I mean, people yell at me, Rowdy, you know, Rowdy Burns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just amazing.
Yeah.
They do all the time. I mean, literally. One of my really favorite movies that I've always wanted to do I don't do a lot of makeup, you know. I don't do a lot of makeup, and so I never do. Because I like when I get emotional, my skin gets red. And, you know, I'm like that Irish kind of thing. And if I get mad, my skin gets red. If I get embarrassed, my skin gets red. If I'm sad, my skin gets red. Okay, so I wanted to do a movie where I had to use a lot. I mean, I was looking for something so that I had to do some makeup of some sort. So I was blessed with a movie called Slither.
Oh, that's a wonderful movie. I love that.
You
much fun. So much fun.
You got to be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I don't know if that was what you were hoping for, though, the end result there, but...
That was an 8-hour makeup, man.
Yeah.
That was, it was brutal, brutal, brutal. Now my comment is, if they'd ever want me to do something like that again, they're going to have to pay me a whole lot of money. Because that was hard work.
Yeah.
I bet it was. What's coming up for you? I know you got a lot of projects on your plate.
Oh my goodness, I got two really good big ones. I got one called Bolden, and it's mm-hmm. about the birth of jazz. And it was produced and directed by Dan Pritzker. And beautiful man, and blessed to have had him and all his money to do this movie, because it's a beautiful piece about a guy named Buddy Bolden back in, 1890s, 1905 is the period. And beautiful piece. We in doing the movie, they convinced us about they didn't convince us, but they pitched this little storyline about a silent movie. We do a silent movie as well. It's just a little silent movie. But let me tell you, nobody does silent movies anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it is hard. It was harder than the feature-length version of the movie Bolt. And the silent movie is called Louis.
It's about Louis Armstrong, right?
Louis Armstrong, yeah. And
right.
it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And it's very funny. I worked with some great actors and actresses in there. Jackie Earl Haley, Amanda Smith. A very, very great up-and-coming young actress. So she's very, very, very beautiful and very talented. And I bless her for every day she had to deal with my craziness. Jackie and I just had a damn good time doing our shtick, So that movie's coming out. So two of those sell 213. I did a movie, Cell 213, directed by Stephen Kay. That's coming out. That's a horror kind of a spooky kind of haunted house movie,
mm-hmm.
but in a prison. So the occupants can't get away. So they're stuck, and I play a very loving, caring individual, a guard, whose job it is to direct people to a certain cell in the prison. And this cell is like, this cell is a cell 213, and it ends up being somewhat of a portal between hell and heaven, and people are sorted out in this cell.
Wow.
And of course I only choose people that I know are going to go straight to hell. So I think my character really loves watching them being tortured and go mentally insane.
that's a great role. That fits
is.
Like
yeah.
a glove.
Oh my goodness! And I've done three little movies that I, you know what? The little independents, you just do them for the heck of it, and yeah, cross your fingers, and you never know if they get a venue, and you never know what's going to happen with them. So hopefully
yeah.
they'll be out well, and of course, you're going to have to look them up on IMDb because I don't really remember their names.
That's all right. That's all right. But they might stick. You never know. They're going to stick.
Exactly.
Oh, the Lena Baker story was one of them. Oh, the Lena Baker story is coming out. That's right. Lena Baker story is coming out. I think it's gotten some sort of a deal with Turner on his network.
Oh, cool.
So it's going to be on one of the little cable stations. And these are little movies that actually should be on cable. And they're not really big theater extravaganzas. So, So anyway,
you did
yeah,
a
some
movie.
some movies are meant for
yeah.
for to play in the home or on cable
yeah.
or
that's very true.
Yeah, absolutely. It's more intimate. You know, you're in a private setting and
exactly.
Well, you did a
movie around the turn of the century called Brown's Requiem, based on a James Ellroy novel, and I thought that was an incredible movie, and
thank
I love James Ellroy, and that was just a wonderful film.
I'm glad you mentioned that film because I got to tell you that was a beautifully done piece. The
mm-hmm.
whole film noir thing has been
perfect.
My heart for a long time, and
yeah.
and to be able to do one, I've been very blessed in my career. I got to tell you, I've been able to do action and drama and horrors and thrillers, and some of them like JFK, and will live forever. I mean, that's going to stand the test of time, and so will some of the kind of the eye candy ones, like Days of Thunder. I mean, people love them, you know, and the little ones like Brown Requiem. I mean, nobody knows of this movie, bro. I mean, it made maybe 5 cents in the theater, you know, maybe $2. Who knows?
But I found this at the video store after reading about it, and I love the book. I read the book in the early 90s, and you know, I read everything by James Ellroy, and it was just really an incredible, I mean, just as good as L.A. Confidential or any of the other, you know, big adaptations of his work. And you know, it's just class, like you said, classic film noir.
I think so, too. I think it's just as good and just as well performed and just as well directed, and the lighting's great, and you know, it's awesome, man. Fun stuff.
Well, Mr. Rooker, we love seeing you in everything you do. And come back and join us in the future, because we really enjoy talking to you tonight.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for having me on your show.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
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 Okay, that's Michael Rooker. Great, great guy. Great body of work. Just an amazing resume. I love hearing about the people that he worked with and the stories.
You love hearing about Al Pacino. Let's not beat around the bush. You loved hearing about him. And who wouldn't? I mean, that was awesome. That was just incredible.
That was an important film for Pacino. I mean,
that's the big film to make him, for our generation, kind of, and for the younger generation, who is this guy? Because he'd been gone for 5 years.
After an absence, he came back.
Yeah.
And honestly, that was the first time I was aware of Pacino. Mm-hmm. I remember I was a senior in high school in 89.
Right.
And I saw a picture of Sea of Love. And for some reason, I just connected that. I thought, that's the coolest looking still.
It's a great film.
Standing there with a sexy Ellen Barkin. And, you know, it looked pretty steamy. I was like, I'm going to go see that tonight. And then I got addicted to Al Pacino's performances from then on.
Yeah, no, and for an introduction, that's a great film. That's a great film.
Yeah, and Michael Rooker is incredible.
Yes,
we have 13 minutes from now, since we're running a little bit late, 13 minutes from now, we're going to welcome Nicholas Goosen on the show. He's the director. We were supposed to interview him last week, and it didn't work out. And then we have an interview with the director of In Search of Beethoven. These are two live interviews.
Right.
We have a 37-minute pre-recorded interview with Bobby Osteen, who is a terrific friend to the show.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to hold off a little bit. If we find that the top of the hour segment doesn't work out, we'll go ahead and play Bobby's interview. Otherwise, we're running late, and I don't know if we have time to fit it in this 2-hour.
Right.
Show, but if not, then we have another show on Wednesday with actor Jason Ritter, and we'll play Bobby then. The interview with Bobby is amazing.
Don't we also have Aaron on Wednesday?
Yes, for you know, the last hour.
Yeah, for David Patterson wannabes. Okay, good. All right, let's.
We'll work it out. But
I know we'll work it out. Whatever.
I just want to make that announcement, but. So you saw Bright Star.
Yeah, I saw Bright Star. And
that,
you know,
was that it this weekend? No, there was something. There was a Bruce Willis, The Surrogate.
Yeah, I saw the Bruce Willis film. Do we really have to talk about that?
Was it Bruce Willis's Johnny Mnemonic?
No, it was. It was just, I don't know. You know, it's like, remember when we were talking about Gamer a couple weeks ago? And I mentioned this movie and Avatar. So it's like really up to Avatar really to like get the virtual reality living vicariously through our virtual reality selves.
Has any film done it better than Strange Days?
No. Yeah. Right now, Strange Days is the top of the game in that department. I think the thing that really strikes me about Surrogates and to a lesser extent about Gamer is that the premise, okay, so we want to basically stay at home and hooked in and let these robots or whatever do everything that we wanted to do. And, you know, we don't have to worry about disease or anything, about getting sick or anything like that, is the argument. It's really, really kind of boring as far as the movie goes. I mean, what the hell's the point of that? I mean, I'm sorry. I want to get out of the house. I don't want to stay in. And, you know, so right there the premise is like, what I'm concerned about is Bruce Willis, who I do like a lot, and right now in the last couple of years, the only two films I can really think of that I really like by are the last Die Hard movie and Planet Terror. There's a lot of strikes on his resume. And I'm hoping that, I think, is he in the Expendables?
I think he said that he was meeting, I think he said that
he needs it.
Robert, he was waiting to hear
he
it.
He needs to be in a movie like that, because we like Bruce. I think Bruce is an excellent actor, actually, whether it's Pulp Fiction or 12 Monkeys, which is in my top 20. But he's a great actor, and he needs to do more challenging work, because this one, I got to tell you, I don't care who was in it. It doesn't matter who was in it. It's just a really boring movie. And you know who it's directed by?
Mastow, Jonathan Mastow.
So he obviously did not get enough of this on Terminator 3. He was like, I really need to go back and work with the machines one more time because I didn't get my fill. And he's just like, dude, what's up with that?
You know, though, he has a good track record.
His first film is incredible, Breakdown.
Breakdown is one of
awesome
the one of the leanest, most efficient thrillers of its kind in the past years. And, you know, U-571 was a triumph for him. That was acclaimed. I think it made money. And then I don't think Terminator 3 is the disaster that everyone
thinks. No, it's not a disaster at all. It's a fun film. I mean, look, it's Arnold's swan song before he becomes governor. I mean, I'll take what I can get.
It makes you miss Schwarzenegger being an actor.
It makes me miss Schwarzenegger, period. Jelly, I need you to come move back to California and help me with the taxes. No, but, you know, it's...
Someone has
like
a question in the chat room.
I have a question.
What is it called when one person is on stage acting out a script? It's called a monologue.
Yeah. That's what I would think.
If I understand the question correctly.
I think so.
We're here for you. We're like ask.com. So, any
like
other questions from the chat room? Worthlessknowledge.com.
No, we're not Worthless Knowledge. We're the greatest things that ever happened to Blog Talk Radio.
That's right.
We really are. Is it a dramatic monologue?
Yes.
Wow, yeah. I mean, it can be dramatic. It can be comedic. It can be, you know.
Yeah. Strange conversation.
It's so, going all over the place.
Reviews are in for a couple of movies, actually. Zombieland, that's something that's getting some praise, and that opens next week, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think it looks really good. It looks very funny. Woody Harrelson, Jesse Eisenberg, who else is in it?
You would ask me, wouldn't you?
I would, Jamie. I would ask you, because I need you. Dude, work with me.
I know. I'll try it, man. I'll try it.
If I'm going to be Don Rickles, can you at least be Carson or Snyder or whoever? Can you at least work with me here, baby?
I'll set him up and you knock him down.
Thanks.
Yeah, Zombieland, and also George Clooney, obviously up in the air. We've discussed that at length and the praise that it's getting. But he also has The Men Who Stare at Goats, which is a kind of political war satire. Yeah,
it's a good book, but I saw the trailer on Friday. I don't know if it can work as a movie. I'm not positive. It's a very good book, but it's a nonfiction, obviously a nonfiction book, and I don't know. This is asking a lot of the audience, but if anyone can pull it off, it is Clooney. And it's got a good cast. Jeff Bridges and Ewan McGregor and Kevin Spacey.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. I mean, that's not your, you know, diamond.
By all accounts, the early reviews say that they do. Also in Zombieland, Abigail Breslin, who's a great actress, and I'm interested in how she'll transition to, you know, teenagehood and adulthood. Bill Murray plays himself in Zombieland.
Well, can we go see this right now?
Exactly.
Dude,
did you hear the story about Bill Murray? This always, whenever I think of Bill Murray, I always think of this story. It always endears me to him even more.
Right.
He was doing some golf tournament, or maybe he was shooting a movie in this town, and he ran upon some college kids, and they said, hey, we're having a big sorority party at this guy's apartment. Would you want to come along? And he did. He spent the evening with the partying college kids, and he mingled, and he handed out drinks and little hors d'oeuvres, and then he ended up washing the dishes at the end of the night. Isn't that the greatest story ever?
Wow, that's awesome. I love Bill Murray. He's incredible. He's just great.
Yeah, and George Romero, his new Dead movie. Legitimate critics, so-called legitimate critics.
What does that mean exactly when you say that? What are you? Who are you including in that?
You know, it's becoming fuzzier and fuzzier because papers, newspapers are dying. So it used to refer to people that are actually printed and published in
mm-hmm.
newspapers. So, I mean, that distinction doesn't really exist anymore. So
they're
let's just say...
film writers. They're all legitimate. And I'm going to, you know, I know you want to, you know, obviously in that you want to include Roger Ebert and Manola Dargis and A.O. Scott and Kev... got the guy from the L.A. Times, but they're all great film writers. Whether you know, we got to really we've had some of the great ones on our show. Keith Ulick, who I love, and we both share a fondness for Michael Fassbender, but also Glenn Kenny, Armand White.
Yes,
the term legitimate critics is disturbing and nasty to me. They're all critics.
I used the wrong term. I'm so sorry. Let's just say mainstream
mainstream. Yeah.
Thank you. They tend to not appreciate it as much as the fans do, and they apparently appreciate it a lot more than Diary of the Dead, which was
that's the impression I'm getting so far.
Yeah, so that's some good news. What's the next film festival that's coming out? I think is Toronto still going on?
I think
Toronto closed.
Shouldn't Toronto be ending? And as we speak, Fantastic Fest is going on, but the next festival? Oh God, I don't know.
Toronto Fest did close, and I closed with Precious being the big story from Toronto Fest.
Yeah, that's the thing to watch. Precious and Up in the Air is the other one, the other Clooney one to watch. And those are the two I know of, but there are other films to look for. But those are the two big like festival films so far.
Yeah. Okay, just another reminder, next Sunday night show will be our tribute to the films of Roman Polanski. It couldn't be more timely.
This is the greatest timing that we've ever had on this show.
Yeah, well, and he's, you know, he's obviously he's a controversial figure, but we're focusing on what makes him a great artist.
Yeah, we're not really focusing on the tabloid stuff, but it's, you know, as we found out today, and it's unavoidable, but we are separating the man from the artist here.
More and more, the interviews that we do, all the testimony to the man, he's extremely generous, enthusiastic, a childlike enthusiasm, a brilliant artist. So we're getting a really full impression of the man too from these interviews.
Yeah, we are, and it's fascinating with the two interviews that I've sat in on so far, and in comparing them to today's events. And just the reaction, but I can't wait. I think next Sunday's show is going to be a milestone for us. So
yeah, and that show includes, of course, as we mentioned, Brett Ratner, who's a close friend of Mr. Polanski, and William Fraker, a legendary cinematographer,
mm-hmm.
and of course Bobby Yostein. I think our next guest is on the line. I believe
he is. Let's do it.
So let's do this. The Shortcut is a new horror film out on DVD this Tuesday. And it's actually it's a really terrific movie, and what's of particular interest to Movie Geeks United listeners. It features a frightening and intense performance from our good friend, Raymond Barre. The film is directed by our next guest tonight, Mr. Nicholas Goosen. But before we welcome on Nicholas, let's give a listen to the trailer to The Shortcut.
When Derek moved to a new town his senior year,
I gotta go for it.
Making friends was not a problem.
Hey, you ever played Truth or Dare?
But soon he will discover that his new town holds a dark past.
A long time ago, some kids went missing from the old high school. They were last seen taking the shortcut. Nobody knows what happened to this day. The old man is up there in that old farmhouse. Stay away from him.
From executive producer Adam Sandler and Happy Madison.
Everyone knows about the crazy old man and the shortcut. Freaking psycho. Kid used to take the shortcut all the time. Then he showed up and started chasing him around with shovels.
What is with this guy?
He's definitely hiding something.
What do you say we do a little investigation of our own?
Beyond the edge of the woods.
So what's the plan?
Head down the shortcut, see what we see.
This is like breaking in.
Seek the truth.
Ma'am?
Discover the secret.
What was that?
You ready?
No.
Shit!
Damn it.
And pray you survive.
We gotta call 911.
We didn't die.
Where are they?
Nobody can escape.
No! Stop! Please.
The shortcut.
Yeah, lots of screaming and crashing cars.
Sounds good to me. Sounds really good to me.
What more do you need? And yeah. Guess what, Jerry? After that long introduction, the call has been dropped from our switchboard.
Oh, dear.
You know, this is why we do fewer and fewer live interviews.
It does seem that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well,
anyway, the short. This is an interesting thing because this is an Adam Sandler production.
Yeah.
And this gentleman has a connection to Adam Sandler, dating back to The Wedding Singer. And Raymond Barre is in it, which I've gone on record as saying that our interview about a year and a half to 2 years ago with Raymond Barre.
Yeah, that one, the movie with Riley, right? That one, I forget what it's called. What's the exact title of that film?
Oh, Walk Hard.
Walk Hard, that's right, Walk Hard.
Yeah, that's what he came on in connection to.
Yeah, that's right. I love that interview. He was so fun to talk to.
Yeah, that's one of my all-time favorite interviews because we really delved into the process of acting and I mean he's been in Dead Man Walking and Born on the 4th of July and just on and on. So many. He's worked with Robert Duvall. And
he's great. No, he's a wonderful actor.
He's terrific. I tell you what, we're going to do. We're going to wait 4 more minutes. For Mr. Goosen to call in, because we had an opportunity to speak to him last week, and it didn't work out. I don't know what happened, but we're going to give 4 more minutes, and then if he doesn't call in, we're going to get to this terrific conversation that we have with our friend Bobby. Okay, so 4 minutes. What should we talk about? Fill the time.
What is going on with the show tonight? Let me ask you this. What was the last movie you saw?
What's the last movie? Oh, well, this is a great conversation here. Ghosts of Girlfriends Past.
Well, how was that? Should I go put that on my Netflix queue?
Probably not. But
why would you say that? Why would you say that? Because it stars one of our finest thespians, Matthew McConaughey, and I'm not joking when I no, dude, you think I'm bullshitting you. You think
no,
I'm making
of course
fun of
not.
Him? No, because I really loved him in Lone Star, and I really thought his part in Tropic Thunder was good. But he was just so awesome and Dazed and Confused. So what is it about
he's great.
Jennifer Gardner that doesn't, like, cut the mustard?
Well, it's fine. I mean, the film is fine. Actually, I watched Observe and Report and Ghost of Girlfriends Past because they were sent to me for DVD reviews. And I preferred Ghost of Girlfriends Past.
Really?
It's one of those films that is as the trailer says it is. I mean, it's not a surprising film. But it's a rainy Sunday afternoon, sit back and enjoy movie. It's not surprising. It's got good performances in it that do their job.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a Christmas Carol take on the romantic comedy. He's a womanizer in the extreme, so he gets to play off that persona. And he's visited by three ghosts of girlfriends past, just as the title speculates. And during which time he learns who his true love is and why love is important in his life.
How's Michael Douglas?
He's fine. I mean, he's
What's with the Michael Douglas? I mean, with the Robert Evans look in the film.
I think that's great. He is appropriately wormy in the film.
Okay.
And nobody plays a worm like Michael Douglas. He is magnetic when he does
you
that.
You tell him that when we have him on for Wall Street 2, okay? You tell him that. I'd like to see you do that. I'd like to see it done in the studio.
I will do that.
We're going to do that interview in a studio, like, the three of us together, okay? Yeah, I'm going to...
So he can punch me out when
I'm going to bring a machete with that one.
So that's a good... Observe and Report, I know it's trying to push boundaries. I didn't find it effective at all. I didn't find it amusing. They've been promoting it as a funny taxi driver.
kind of. It's kind of. It grew on me. I gotta say, like when after walking out of the theater, I was like, you know, I didn't think much of it. But the more I thought about it, like I thought it had some good touches. I don't think it's. I mean, look, the guy's Jody Hill's first film, The Foot Fist Way, is incredible. With Danny McBride, I love that film. I do like Observer and Report. I think the more I think about it, the more I like it. You know, while watching, I'm just like, huh? What's up with this? But the more I think about it, I gotta say, it's a good film.
I didn't like it at all.
You want to come over and watch it with me? And maybe
No, I don't think that'll help. I don't think anything about it works. And honestly, I think Taxi Driver is a funny movie. Not obviously when it all goes to hell, but there are moments of very sophisticated subtle humor in De Niro's behavior in Taxi Driver that you know your perception of. Enhances after repeated viewings of Taxi Driver.
Well, I mean, like, I agree. I mean, I understand where you're coming from. It's not, there are a lot of people did not like Observer and Report. It's not like, you know, one of these things. It was, I don't even know if it's a comedy, really. I don't even consider it a comedy. But, like, Kim Morgan was the first at Sunset Gun said it reminded her a lot of Taxi Driver in many ways. And then other people started saying Taxi Driver. And I was like, you know, I see the Taxi Driver. I was thinking more King of Comedy, maybe. But, it's an interesting. It grows on me. It didn't hit me immediately. It's not one of those things like you walk. Oh, that's the greatest movie I've ever made. You need to think about it. But I don't hate it. I'm psychotic though, and look, I'm going to say this right now. I'm psychotic. How can you ever trust anything that comes out of my mouth? I'm psychotic.
I essentially never do. But those are the last two.
You're absolutely right in this regard. I mean.
Those are the last two I've seen.
Okay,
so our next guest is not called in. He stood us up once again.
Oh, my God.
It's becoming a trend for us.
Yeah,
so what we're going to do is we're going to cut to our next interview with Bobbi Yostein. She is terrific. Let me read a little bit about her here. Bobbi Yostein is an accomplished Emmy-nominated editor, instructor, and author. Not to mention one of our favorite guests and favorite people. She has two books in release, Cut to the Chase, which details the teachings of her late husband of 23 years, legendary editor Sam Osteen, and The Invisible Art, which is an essential examination of the elusive art of editing. And you can purchase both of these books from our website here. Just click on the icon of the book covers on the homepage there, and it'll take you directly to Amazon where you can purchase those. Recently, Bobby moderated panels at two stellar events, EditFest New York and EditFest LA. And these two events were attended by a great number of eager artists who wanted to learn from the masters in the field of editing. You can read more about these events at her website, bobbiosteen.com. But first, take a listen to this terrific conversation where we discuss these events and the legendary work of her husband and so much more. Here's Bobby. Of course, we discussed earlier in your previous appearance that your father was an editor, but you actually went to school and studied anthropology. So I'm wondering, when did the idea of pursuing filmmaking and film editing come to you?
Well, I studied film at Stanford as well.
Okay.
And I was really immersed in that world all my life because of my exposure through my father. I also played a dual role in the biggest film that USC had ever made at the age of 14. Just coincidentally, it was another exposure to USC and filmmaking students. I think anthropology it's an approach to, I mean, I think it did enrich my life studying anthropology because I think movie crews and movie sets and movie experiences are like going into different countries all the time, and there are different ways of behaving and ways of interacting and standards, and I traveled a lot all my life too because of my father's work, so I just.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I was able to really appreciate the movie making experience as a culture in itself every
time.
Yeah.
And when back then, when you were college age or younger, and you were associating with other young filmmakers, that had to have been an exciting time. But contrast that to today, when you speak to young film students, or I know there are many apprentice film editors that attended the Edit Fest events that we'll be talking about in a little bit. Are they different at all?
Yes. One of the things that's starting to happen, I think it took a while because, you know, computers started to really be used a lot in the 90s, and there are wonderful things about computers that opened up a whole new world. But the downside and the master editors and the people like me who are trying to you know, like in The Invisible Cut, the way I was trying to explain and analyze the process as if you're writing the scene again, because mm-hmm. the editor is the last storyteller. This whole process of what goes through an editor's head when he's making the cut, the assistant editor no longer experiences it the same way with computers. Mm-hmm. And what used to happen with a Moviola is that the assistant would stand behind an editor and physically hand him film to work with. And so the assistant would literally stand over his shoulder and watch him thinking as he's cutting. Editors talk out loud, too, by the way. Should I use that close-up? I don't know. They curse at the Moviola. But they really, they're missing out on that now. And I think one of the reasons why Edit Fest was such a success was because these were all young working editors. They weren't film buffs, most of them. They really want to learn from the masters. And what happens with computers is the assistant editor is usually in another room and still doing the same thing, only it's not physical. They're cataloging the film and the trims and the dailies, but they're not observing the process. They can look at what the editor did after he's done it and say, oh, I see, did that, mm-hmm. this and that. But they're missing out on a very, very specific kind of storytelling that the editor has to go through. And the other difference is that with splices, you really had to think about what you were going to do before you did it much more carefully, because every splice showed, and you couldn't second guess yourself that much, because otherwise it was kind of embarrassing to see all those splices, you know, running through the projector. And so the editor would really have to ask him, her, or herself all those questions: what is the story about, who am I supposed to be rooting for, what is supposed to happen in the course of this scene, am I supposed to change my feelings about the character, how does it fit in the whole context of the movie? When they interviewed, they had one of the questions that came up on one of the panels, they asked five different editors what their process was, and every one of them gave a different answer.
Hmm.
And that would not have been true with a Moviola.
Right. Because really, with computerized editing, you can experiment. The possibilities might have been limitless before, but now you can actually physically see all of those possibilities in front of you, and so it probably would be more challenging to make a decision finally about what works best for you.
You have to, you know, you don't have to be a few steps ahead of yourself anymore. You can,
uh-huh.
you don't have to really have the architecture of the scene in your head, and there are wonderful things because you can make a million mistakes, and you can be braver.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, there's this basic, and I really feel that young editors are, they may not specifically know why or have analyzed it, but I think they somehow know that they're missing out on the master editor's process.
Right,
you
right.
know?
And I think it's really important what you said about being a storyteller, because really every member of a film crew is an assistant storyteller. I watch interviews with someone like Harrison Ford likes to refer to himself not as an actor but as an assistant storyteller, and you actually had a lot of experience previous to going into the editing field with story editing and screenwriting. That must have been important training.
It was really helpful to me because the editor is not only the storyteller, they're the last storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the end of the line, and there's nothing. This is it, you know. And I think story editing was really, really helpful for me because you really deconstruct every moment and every scene, and you have to see how the scene plays in context of the whole story. And again, you have to ask yourself all those questions about, be the audience and say, how do I feel about this scene, and do I really need this scene, and or maybe it shouldn't come here, or what are the dramatic arcs in the scene? All those questions that the editor should ask themselves before they ever sit down and actually start cutting.
Right. And that's also some great reasons why the relationship between editor and director is so crucial. We spoke about that at length your last visit with us. When you started editing, did you start an apprenticeship under Sam on Straight Time? Was that the first apprenticeship?
No, I had done a few other films before that, but that was still when there was a union system where you had to put in a certain amount of years before you could cut, which
right.
is no longer the case, and that's actually a good thing, I think.
We talked about Invisible Cut last time you were on, but we didn't spend a lot of time talking about Cut to the Chase, which was your previous book of conversations with your husband about the art of editing. And he, of course, was one of the top world-renowned editors. Where did the seeds of that idea come from to create that book?
I just felt that I knew all his stories. And because his career started off, he was apprenticing under editors that had actually cut silent movies, and he went all the way through to the computer era. So he really, his career spanned the entire history of film editing, and he worked with so many incredible personalities and talents, you know, what Mike Nichols and Roman Polanski and Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor and Frank Sinatra. And so, I mean, there was a lot of interesting, he was on the set a lot, which was unusual for an editor. And so he was privy to the cutting room stories, but also stories on set. So, and he wasn't really much of a talker, but it was, people would say to me, how did you get him to talk and tell all these stories? Because I knew the stories, and I'd say, Sam, talk about that moment where Richard Burton does such and such. And he would then tell me those stories. But then what else we also did was we would run all the movies. And I would just have the tape recorder running, and I would say, tell me when you want me to stop and you have something to say. And he was a great storyteller. And, you know, he like a lot of editors who say they're not talkers, once they start talking, they really are. They're storytellers.
Sure.
And Sam used to say, if you want to know what makes a good editor, it's someone who can tell a joke really well because they know what to tell and what to leave out.
Sure.
And so I had no idea he was going to pass away. He had nothing. He wasn't sick or anything. It was just, I just thought, this is amazing. And I think what encouraged me to write the second book, well, I was commissioned by my publisher, but also I realized because I had a history of writing and editing, and I straddled both worlds, I really was able to explain the editing process. And it's kind of difficult because it's a visual medium, but, you know, with Sam's, the inspiration of Sam's work, and then my own understanding of the process of editing, I was able to do that. And now I feel very, you know, with Invisible Cut, it kind of gave me this impetus. I really want to educate and help people really understand the art, the invisible art of editing, because it is an invisible art.
It absolutely is, and that's why I think you're so fantastic, because reading your books, you're able to articulate very clearly the nuts and bolts of that art. And I think it was invaluable, the different examples you used in Invisible Cut. Then you went frame by frame and examined the pacing and the theories behind the cutting style. So I loved Invisible Cut.
Thank you.
Now I wanted to ask you about one director that your husband worked with most often, and you mentioned him, Mike Nichols. What was that relationship? Because obviously they connected.
Well, I think they were an interesting combination of contrasts. I do talk in both my books about the marriage of the editor and director, and if you liken that relationship to a marriage, you can say sometimes compliments work best. And they had very different temperaments. Sam was a very instinctual, not especially verbal person, and Nichols was all about words, and not especially comfortable with the mechanical visual aspects of filmmaking. It was about performances and words and a very intellectual background. And Sam was very, very instinctual, very kind of no-nonsense, cut to the chase, if you'll excuse the expression, personality. So I think that, and also Sam was a very, very optimistic person, very confident, very solid personality. He didn't get rattled. He'd say things like, it's just shadows on the wall. Or, Mike, one day you drive by the theater and it'll be there, up there on the screen. I mean, up there on the marquee, and Nichols was much more intense, and he would thrive when things were going badly, but when things were going well, he would get anxious. So right. I think he appreciated Sam's calm, And I just think that the sensibilities, the intellectual versus the more, I don't know how to put it, sort of street smart, even rough-edged, but no-nonsense way Sam had about him was a really good combination. And
yeah.
And which was true with in a different way with Polanski, that Polanski had a more European sort of languid-paced sensibility, and Sam was always trying to shorten his movies. But that sensibility was also beautiful. So, he's sort of getting the best of both.
Edit Fest. Now, Edit Fest New York and L.A., you moderated panels at both events.
Right.
Is this the first year for this?
This is the first time they've ever done it in New York this past June. And they had only done it once before in L.A. And no one has ever done anything like this. No one has ever done a weekend or a festival where the master editors just talk about their work and how they got their breaks. A lot of it is talking about the process and, the whole aesthetics and theory of filmmaking and their sensibilities and their techniques. But also they gave a lot of interesting advice about how to make the most of opportunities and how they got their breaks, which just was revealing, and and there are so many interesting personalities. I mean, and then there's a difference between the two Edit Fests, I thought, too, the difference in New York film culture and L.A. film culture, or film editing culture, I should say, because New York is so much smaller. and the opportunities are fewer, but everybody knows everybody more. It's like a boutique industry.
Hmm.
And
so who attended, who was this geared towards? Just
it really was geared towards young aspiring or working film editors.
Okay.
And when you saw shows of hands about various questions, it was clear that most of them were actually already working.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's what made me really think about they're already working and they still want to learn because they're not necessarily learning.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that hasn't changed is you have to have an editor who's secure enough and nice enough to let you cut and show them things and have that editor tell you, ask you why you made the choices you did and give you advice. And that will never change. You can do that on a computer or you can do that on a Moviola. But I just think that there are so many brilliant editors who may not be around forever that these young film editors want to learn from. And they ask really smart questions. And that's when I could kind of tell they were really working editors.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't like gossip questions or, you know, just trivial questions. They were really
right.
Insightful.
So who were some of the guests there that spoke to them?
Well, they had different both EditFest had the same panels.
Okay.
There was a comedy panel, which was hilarious. There was feature film. The first night is breaking into the business, and they would tell their stories about that. The second day was the art of cutting comedy, the documentary edit, editing television, and editing features. And it was really they were all very, very talented people and had great stories to tell, really great stories. My particular panel in New York was interesting because a lot of them had worked on the same shows and they were friends with each other, and I thought this is not the case that where editors are, you know, competitive and begrudging other people jobs. I was very surprised to see how supportive they were of one another, because technically they're rivals, you
mm-hmm.
know. They had all worked, 4 out of 5 had worked on the Wire, and they had worked on 30 Rock. I noticed the New York editors maybe a little more than the LA editors, because the jobs are more limited. They would do a lot of different things. Like when there was no work in television, they would cut a documentary, then they might cut an indie feature. And you didn't seem to be as categorized or compartmentalized in New York because that's just the way it worked.
Right, right. And you talked about the different panels: television, feature film, documentary, comedy. So through the information gleaned from these panels, there's a definite distinction in their style of cutting between these different genres of films, or is it
all the
same?
Well, you know what? One of the things that came out, and is actually one of my questions to both of my panels, was, is there a difference between cutting comedy and drama? And the truth is, there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's still getting the truth out of the film, and it's all about timing and pacing. And if it's funny, if it's not funny, there are no miracles in the cutting room.
Mm.
So if it's not working dramatically, it's not working. And the editor can help things along, but one of the questions that came up is, can you make something funny that isn't? Not really. You can make it the best it can be, but you can't sprinkle cinnamon on shit, as Polanski would say. I hope
right.
I swear.
No, that's good. That's good.
That is a direct quote. So
that's
that was interesting. And you know, you just the there really isn't. It's a definitely universal aspect to editing that was clear, regardless of what the style of the movie was or what the medium was. It's all pretty much comes down to the same basics.
Mm-hmm. And one of the guests there, guest speakers, Joel Cox, and he's Clint Eastwood's editor. And Eastwood is a fascinating director for a number of reasons, but one reason is the fact that he doesn't shoot a lot of takes. He's like a 1, 2, at most 3 take guy.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't imagine there would be a lot of choices in the cutting room.
But I think those choices are probably it's about finesse, and they're still subtle choices that mean a lot. Mm-hmm. Subtlety can have a big impact. I think he's a great guy. It was so strange because I was actually standing outside talking to Brent White, who is the Judd Apatow's editor,
mm-hmm.
and I missed the beginning of his panel, and Randy Roberts, who's the president of ACE, came running out and he said, "Bobby, Joel Cox just said that Sam was responsible for making him what he is today as an editor."
Wow.
Or made some incredible statement about Sam, and Sam hadn't really talked about Joel Cox, so I was really curious, and afterwards I talked to him for a very long time about Sam, and this is partly in reference to what you were saying about Clint Eastwood's style of shooting, is Sam's, so I asked him what he meant, and he said two things that really impacted on him about Sam. They were all, there was a whole group of assistants that were struggling to make it together at Warner Brothers. And he said Sam stood out to him because he was so resolved to just wait. He was so determined from the age of 8, really, when he had a paper route at Warner Brothers, to be an editor. He was going to wait forever, and he was determined to be an editor. That was his life's goal. And he was 38 when he finally started cutting.
Wow.
He was 10 years in the print shop, 8 years the union required him to work as assistant and apprentice, and that determination was so inspiring to Joel. And the other thing, and this goes back to I'm finally getting to the Clint Eastwood style of shooting, is that Sam never looked at anything before he showed it to the director. He would cut it and just put it on the bench, and that confidence was crazy to me. I couldn't believe that he wouldn't want to just check his film, but he didn't want to second guess himself.
Hmm.
And I think that the beauty of the way Clint Eastwood works, and I can see it in Joel's personality as well, is this very decisive, very confident way of shooting. He comes from the school of television, the whole Rawhide experience, and also Don Siegel, who was kind of mentored him. The influence was to shoot things very efficiently, quickly, find a very tight team that you trust, and just do it.
Yeah.
And don't look back, don't second guess, don't shoot a million takes, don't overshoot, don't meander through the process, just a very, very clear-eyed, determined way of working. And I could see, I was wondering if, you know, they say when people are married for a long time, they start to walk and talk alike. Joel Cox really reminds me of Clint Eastwood. He has this very, he just like kind of this macho, no-nonsense kind of, even like the voice, the tone, and it's very funny. But
wow.
I think that in this case, you know, you're talking about Sam and Nichols having different personalities. In their case, I would say more similar personalities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you talked about TV earlier. A lot of the panelists worked in TV, and I would think certainly there's a lot of work to be had in the TV genre, but is the specific the challenges that are specific to television, I would think a lot of it would have to do with time, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because I thought of it as a negative thing. Like, you know, they say, first of all, that television is a producer's medium and that the directors have 4 days. That's actually true. They have 4 days to recut the film according to how they want it. And then they don't have to honor any of those cuts. So the directors really have very little rights. And I come from the feature film world, so it's sort of appalling to me. But what I heard from the editors, specifically on a show like The Wire, where you have the creator is also the writer, and he has a very clear vision of the tone, the style of the show, it can be actually a very nice thing because you're not babysitting personalities. You're not, you know, everybody understands this is the way it's done. Like The Wire has a very specific style, which is very realistic. There's only source music. They don't have flashy camera angles that aren't specifically the actual point of views of the characters or a completely objective point of view. So what I found from Kate Sanford particularly mentioned this to me. She said that she finds it wonderful to work, to have that comfort level and the sort of known feeling of going into that cutting room and having a certain dictates already set up. Mm-hmm. And she thought it was in a way easier. I mean, it doesn't always work that way, but I think it can happen. And the other funny thing they talked about is, and I didn't even know this, that they don't know what's going to happen on those shows. They intentionally keep them in the dark about what future episodes are. They don't want to telegraph it in their editing. They think it'll influence their editing.
Huh.
So it's once again the objectivity of the editor being the audience. So Kate gave me an example of, there was an insert shot that they had shot for some scene in The Wire, and she put it in. She didn't put it in because she thought it was sort of cheesy. And they said, oh, no, you have to put that in because in episode 5 it will mean something.
Huh.
And then one of the editors said, well, actually, I don't know if they do that to keep our objectivity or they're just power mad and they don't want it to know. And they said,
right.
One of them said, I can't remember which editor said this, I really wanted to sneak into that room and see what how the story was going to evolve, you know.
That, I've been curious about that because when I think about series and I think about actors, when actors play their role, they don't have the benefit of knowing the arc of the character. So would that be detrimental? Is that a hindrance? Or does that allow you to just exist in that moment? And I guess it's the same question with the editor that you're expressing.
Yeah, I think what happens is, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm not really sure, but I think what probably happens is, when there's something they need to know, they do tell them in terms of the character too, not just the plotting of it. But I'm not really sure about that. I do think that it's something that had never occurred to me. I just assumed everybody was in on everything. And speaking about the director's rights and everything, one of the things I thought was very touching is one of my panelists was editing. She actually just got her second Emmy for this, for editing Breaking Bad, which I don't know if you've seen that show.
Right, yes.
It's an amazing show. And in this particular, Lynn Willingham is her name. And in this particular show, she said that the producer-creator actually hires a lot of indie film directors, which is kind of unusual. But she says it's hard for them because they're not journeymen, and they get upset when they don't get to have more creative control. So I think that can be – it's just different. It's a different – you know, I think if like David Chase, you know, these really brilliant writer creators, I think that can be a very positive thing, but I feel for all creative people, and I can see that, you know, it's something that they know going in, though. There's no surprises. This is the way it works. This is,
yeah.
They talked about different cultures. This is the television culture, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Before we go, I want to ask you this question, because I know your husband ventured into directing, and we've spoken to other editors that have done the same on the show. Is there a benefit to that, to coming from the editing world and becoming a director? Is there a benefit of that previous experience as an editor?
Oh, I think there's definitely a benefit, because the editor has to preconceive all the film that was shot before he starts cutting, and really shoot it again in his head. And I think most editors who become directors are able to pre-visualize, because it's first of all their talent. You have to have that talent, but they've also had the experience of being able to do that. And I just think, honestly, I think everybody who wants to become a filmmaker or a director should hang out in the cutting room.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Sam said that always. You know, I've just, on the write-ups I've gotten about Invisible Cut, strangely enough, it hasn't just been editors saying, some of the editors said, I wish I had this book when I was first starting out. But then I got also input from filmmakers, screenwriters, and directors who said, you know, these kind of basic issues that you have to grapple with in the cutting room, you know, examining every scene and justifying your edits and constantly being aware of telling the story in the best possible way, it has to help you when you're directing. You know,
mm-hmm.
you just, your whole sensibility is focused on the characters and the story.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. It's endlessly fascinating to me, editing, because it's the, we've said over and over again, it's the invisible art. So how do you know when you've seen good editing? I guess it's when you don't notice it.
It's true. And I mean, except the only exception would be if you're cutting an action scene and you really want it to be dizzying and the adrenaline to be going and you want to be thrown all over the place, you would notice the cuts, but you may not even then. It may just be a visceral thing. But
yeah.
I'm going to do something really nice for you now, because last time I was on your show, Angelina Jolie, all I had to do was say that name and supposedly would spike your ratings.
Oh,
I'm going to tell you a good story about that Angelina Jolie story.
Oh, great, great. Let's hear it.
And it's part of what we just talked about. Even with Edit Fest, when they were organizing it, they asked Joel Cox, why don't you show like an exciting action scene from Gran Torino? And instead, he chose a very quiet scene from The Changeling,
mm-hmm.
with Angelina Jolie. And it was just two people. It was a scene, is very, very powerful, very quiet, tension-filled scene between her and the director of the asylum. And he's trying to mess with her mind. And,
right.
And it's all about those choices that an editor makes in a scene like that are so much more difficult and significant than an action scene. I mean, and even editors don't fully grasp that. If you ever notice, usually movies that are nominated for Oscars are very heavy on car chases and action. And it's not to say that it's you know, not a challenging thing to do, but it's much harder to shoot a scene, a very tension-filled scene where the psychology of the characters is playing out,
mm-hmm.
than just the visual challenge of cutting an action scene and keeping, you know, you have to keep everybody straight, make sure you know where everybody is in relation to each other in an action scene, and you have to keep the story going, but it's still, it's not nearly as impressive. And that Joel Cox was, you know, talked about that. He said, people don't understand that this is what matters when you're trying to instruct people about how to cut a scene. So he picked it, you know, he explained what he did in the scene, and it was much more educational than anything that you could have said about a car chase, you know, or a fight.
Yeah, I think that's very valuable, especially coming from, I mean, the phrase is so old now, but the music video generation, where everything is bam, bam, bam. I think showing a scene like that is very valuable, and like we discussed before, and letting a scene breathe, and the little moments and the little tells that an editor has control over.
And, you know, and the other thing is you have to have both. You know, movies are a series of arcs, and you can't have all, you know, noise and loud, I don't mean literally loud, but, you know, just very high action, high energy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you have to start over again. You have to have peaks and valleys of energy, and that's a very important part of editing as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got to tell you, Bobby, I love talking to you. Actually, every year when they announce the Oscar nominees, we set up a panel and we bring different people in for the different categories. I'd love for you to talk about the editing category when those nominations come out with us.
Oh, I would love to do that.
Oh, that would be excellent. That would be excellent.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Bobby Osteen. And she will return to us for next week's Martin Polanski. Roman Polanski tribute.
Roman.
Yes. I'm so sorry. We're running late tonight, and our next guest has been generous enough. He's been on hold, and now he just called back in. I definitely want to speak to this gentleman. His movie is amazing to close out the show. So I apologize, and I thank him for calling back in. Let me bring up his intro. this show is not going well today. In Search of Beethoven is the first comprehensive feature-length cinema documentary ever made about Beethoven, featuring over 60 live performances. And the man behind the lens of this project is director Phil Grabsky, whose previous works include Muhammad Ali, Through the Eyes of the World, Half-Life, A Journey to Chernobyl, and In Search of Mozart. The film is currently playing at Cinema Village in New York City, and it opens wider. It's in Long Island, upstate New York, Cleveland, and Los Angeles in the weeks ahead. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show director Phil Grabsky. Let me bring up his line.
Hello?
Mr. Grabsky, hi.
Hello, good evening.
We got you on the phone. I apologize so much for the...
No problem.
It's an honor to have you on the show tonight. Give me a sense, before we start into your Beethoven project, of how you got into filmmaking. Were documentary films of particular influence to you when you were younger?
When I was a child, I wanted to be a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to photography college when I was 18, and while I was there, changed my mind to film. Made my first film when I was 19 about the Dalai Lama of Tibet, who then was 25 years in exile. And that was sold to television, and they said, would you make us another one? And off I went. Here I am 25 years later.
Yeah, and you're
and
still
all
doing
I,
it.
All I want to do is documentaries.
Really? So what excites you about the form in particular?
You can't beat real life. I mean, you can spend $100 million if you want to try and recreate real life in a Hollywood fiction film. You can't beat real life. I've been walking around New York today, and the conversations that you just catch snatches of are just unbelievable. You could make a film about any of these people on this
mm-hmm.
street.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that links what I do is I'm absolutely fascinated by human creativity, what we are capable of. And whether it's a little boy in Afghanistan living now, which is the film I'm doing now, living in terrible circumstances, but still very funny, very creative, very energetic, or whether it's great sportsmen, Pelé, Muhammad Ali, or great composers, Mozart, Beethoven, I just love to kind of try and work it out. What's history? What's parenting? What's luck? Now, why them? Why did that little baby born in a little attic room in Bonn, Germany, why does he become the greatest composer of all time, or arguably one of all time?
Absolutely. And we love documentaries on this show, and actually we just counted down our top 20 films of the past 20 years, and I think one of the all-time great achievements is the 7-Up series, the Michael Apted series. So we are completely with you on the documentary form. In terms of the process of making documentaries, this is a question I always like to ask documentary filmmakers. You start out the project maybe with one notion of what your movie will be, but it inevitably morphs into something else during the process of making it, doesn't it?
Well, I think the first thing is you do not make a film for a perceived market. You don't think, what does the broadcaster want? What does the audience want? It's an overused word, but it genuinely has to be something that enthralls you, you're passionate about, you're interested in, because it's going to be really tough. You won't raise the money. You're going to have real difficulties. You're going to be traveling on night trains through Europe with all your high-definition gear, and you can't afford an assistant. So the first thing is, what is it that interests me? What am I trying to find out? The second thing which is important is, and a lot of documentaries don't have this really, is what's the thesis? What am I trying to say here? What's the point? It's not enough just to say this happens, that happens. Get underneath the skin a little bit and then begin with an open mind. You know, the received wisdoms that Beethoven was miserable all his life, misanthropic, misogynist, you know, he was nasty, he was, you know, put all that out of your mind, as I did with Mozart. You know, I tried to get Tom Hulce and Amadeus out of my mind and look for yourself. And the way that I do it is because I film things myself, is I go to the greatest conductors or musicians on the planet and I say, tell me, what is it about this piece that is so fantastic? Now, you know, Emmanuel Ax, he sits there, it's very funny, he sits there and says, you know what, I can't play it. What, you know, Beethoven's doing this as a joke. He's saying, look, I'm writing this, I can play it, nobody else can.
What did you discover in making In Search of Beethoven was your ultimate theme?
Well, what's interesting is that, of course, as I said, with Mozart, you have the film Amadeus to work against. So people thought that was the real Mozart, and in my film I can show you that he's actually different to that. There hasn't really been a great film about Beethoven, so people aren't really that clear in their mind. They just imagine this kind of white-haired, old, grumpy guy. What I wanted to find out was, what was he really like? And the character that emerges in the film is really quite different. That was exciting for me because I didn't set out to prove him to be different. I didn't know what he was like, really. But when you start reading all the letters, start listening to the music, talking to people, visiting the locations, it's far more interesting, really. This far more interesting character emerges, which helps you understand the music. Now, I don't believe that any human being with warm blood coursing through their veins, if they sat down quietly, you know, no distractions, and not embarrassed in front of their young teenage friend, whatever it might be, sit them down in front of the Ninth Symphony, the Fifth Symphony, the Piano Concerti, the Violin Concerto, they will be absolutely blown away. Now, who was the man that wrote it? Why did he write it? You know, who was he writing it for? What was happening with instruments that suddenly allowed this to be written? Pianos, for example, were changing all the time, and you can understand some of the new pieces that he writes because he has this new, louder piano, you know, etc. It's like technology. To understand me as a filmmaker in 50 years' time, you'd have to understand that the camera technology is changing. Emails, iPods, iPhones, all this kind of stuff all allow me to make these kind of films in a way that I couldn't 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear Beethoven. I mean, I hear it on cell phones. I heard it last night on a program on television. You hear Beethoven all the time. You can't walk on this planet for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years and not be interested in this all-time great genius. That which isn't to say that he was perfect. It's not to say that this is a hagiography which says, oh, the man could do no wrong. That's not really the point of the film. The point of the film is, who was he?
Yeah, and the creative process is endlessly fascinating to me. And you mentioned Amadeus, and the only film that comes to mind with Beethoven is the Gary Oldman Immortal Beloved. But where did his genius come from, if that can be defined?
Well, in a way, it can't. I mean, you can't really define what one is born with. whether that is natural or God-given. It's indefinable. So what I look at is, what can I identify? Historical context. It is very significant, the period in which Beethoven grows up. He grows up at the time of the French Revolution. There's a moment when he goes to Vienna. He gets involved in some scams. He tries to pull off a few tricks. He gets found out. And his boss, back in Bonn, says, I think it's time you came home. Just at that moment, French armies arrive, and his boss, the Elector of Bonn, has to flee, and Beethoven's left to stay in Vienna. Mm. Had that not happened, he would have remained a servant of the church in Bonn, and we never would have heard of him, probably.
Right.
So what you can look at then is history, what his father was like, who the contemporaries were. I mean, you know, to understand Beethoven, you have to understand Mozart and Haydn. All these things help answer those questions. Ultimately, you know, it's fate, it's luck. Who knows why this one guy? But I mean, I think there are lots of things in the film which kind of give you a sense of why this person has survived and many others haven't, in terms of our collective musical memory.
It's a beautiful film, and we have about 4 minutes left because we're running late on the show today. But I wanted to ask you about the music that you use for the film. When you're doing a film on a composer such as Mozart or Beethoven, do you find yourself in the editing room structuring the piece around the musical selections in a way?
Definitely. I mean, we start off with this list, which develops as we go along. I mean, it's a two-and-a-half-year project, but you have this list of 60 bits of music that you want to try and get for various reasons, either because they're great or because it's biographically important or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get them, I mean, I'll go and film a symphony. It might be 50 minutes long. I'm only going to use 2 or 3 minutes, so which 2 or 3 minutes? And then the way that you edit it has to reflect the piece, reflect where it's coming in the film. And in a way, this is why it's great to see it in the cinema. I mean, this is a cinema film.
Yes.
At the Music Hall, the Lemley Music Hall, that's the best place to see it because it's a cinematographic experience, but also an oral audio experience too. Because one of the people says in the film is that the thing that is astounding about Beethoven is that each piece creates its own sound world, which is not really true of Mozart in the same way, not true of Haydn, but every piece that Beethoven writes is somehow different in terms of its kind of musical world. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's extraordinary. Anybody, whatever your age, whatever the music you're into, will be inspired and moved by the music of Beethoven. And in many ways, of course, when Beethoven died, all the contemporary composers said, well, what do we do? He's done it all. Where do we go?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is why, in some ways, they all went off in completely new directions. I can't tell you how extraordinary his life is, really.
Yeah. And I highly recommend this film to anyone. And you're right, it does demand to be seen in a cinema. And it's currently playing at the Cinema Village in New York City. And there'll be dates around the U.S., including Long Island. It's started the other day, Friday, in Long Island. Upstate New York, it started Saturday, being Cleveland and Los Angeles. Check the website in search of Beethoven.com for more information.
That's right. It's L.A. on Friday. And I'll be there. I'm doing Q&As at Cleveland Wednesday, Kansas Thursday, Los Angeles Friday and Saturday, and then I head off with it to, which is great for me, New Zealand and Australia.
Where in Los Angeles are you going to?
It's at the Lemley Music Hall.
Oh, that's a great theater. I love that place.
Good. I'm looking forward to it. And obviously, if it does well, if I'm allowed to say this, if we get bums on seats, then, you know, they extend it and they might put it out to other cinemas as well. It's all about money, ultimately.
Right.
But you know, it's done very well here in New York. Every screening gets bigger and, you know, more and more crowded. So I'm confident it'll do well.
Well, you couldn't ask for a more fascinating subject, I really urge everyone to come see it. I wanted my listeners to be exposed to the film. It's wonderful. And Mr. Grabsky, I'm so sorry that we ran out of time tonight, but you're so wonderful for hanging in there and calling in and talking
to us.
Thank you
so much.
No, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I
hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Phil Grabsky. It's Search of Beethoven playing in select theaters now. Check the website in searchofbeethoven.com. We did it, man.
We did it. We did it all. We did it all tonight, and that's awesome. And we'll be back Wednesday night with a whole brand new show.
Yes, and our mystery song of last week was You Can Leave Your Hat On by Joe Cocker from 9½ Weeks. I was about to say You Can Leave Your Pants On.
Well, I was hoping you would say that. Okay, whenever.
Here is our mystery movie song. It won't be a mystery once it starts to play. We're going to go from Beethoven to this for this week. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
All right, thanks, everyone. Good night.
We'll see you Wednesday night.